watching you. Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Let me ask you a question. Do you feel like somebody's watching you? Think about that for just a moment. Right now, as you're sitting in your car, at home, listening to this, wherever you are, do you feel like somebody's just looking over your shoulder? Maybe that guy across the cafe behind the sunglasses? Maybe someone over your cell phone or through your computer? You might be tempted to think that that's just paranoid, but I have some bad news for you. Somebody may actually be watching you, and that somebody may be your government. Now, this is not one of those conspiracy radio shows. This is a reasonable show about the Constitution, and the Constitution supposedly protects our privacy, right? There's that thing called the Fourth Amendment, you know, searches and seizures, probable cause. We're protected, right? Well, I recently spoke with a federal judge by the name of Stephen Smith, a guy who should know about these things, and he's a little bit concerned that maybe we're not protecting our privacy the way we should. In fact, he just recently written a law review article in which he discusses something called secret surveillance orders, surveillance orders that are handed out by federal judges like himself without anyone knowing. Let me repeat that. Orders that go out to watch us, to use electronic means to watch us, things like our cell phones, our computers, our text messages, our emails, all those things. And you may be the subject of one of those orders, and you may never, ever find out about it. Well, Judge Smith is concerned about such things, and we recently spoke on this topic. Well, Judge Stephen Smith, thanks so much for being on your weekly constitutional.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? What do you do these days?
Well, I'm a magistrate judge, a U.S. magistrate judge, working in the Southern District of Texas in Houston, Texas.
Now, you're not originally from Texas, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm originally from Tennessee. I grew up in Jackson, Tennessee.
And a fine state it is. We're very partial to Tennessee here, so we're glad to hear that.
I still am, too.
Well, I'm sure you are. Now, tell me, what is, for those, this is a show about the Constitution, and we've talked in the past about federal judges. How do federal magistrate judges fit into the federal judicial system?
Federal magistrate judges are what's referred to as adjuncts to the district courts around the country. We are not what's known as Article III judges, like district judges and courts of appeal and Supreme Court judges or justices, are nominated by the president and approved by the Senate, and they serve life terms.
Mm-hmm.
Magistrate judges are actually hired by district courts. We serve 8-year terms. There's a statutory process by which you interview and are apply for and are selected. It's generally a merit-based type of program. They have a committee that evaluates applications and then makes recommendations to the district court, and then the district judges actually make those decisions. So, but magistrate judges, once we're on board, we do a wide range of duties, assisting district judges to handle their dockets, both on the civil side and the criminal side. Actually, magistrate judges have the authority, with the consent of all the litigants, to actually try a jury trial in a civil case,
mm-hmm,
to judgment and issue final judgments and opinions. On the criminal side, our duties are more along pretrial proceedings. We handle initial appearances when a defendant is initially arrested on a federal charge. He's the first judicial officer he will see will be a magistrate judge, and the magistrate judge will inform the defendant of his rights, make sure he has counsel or an attorney, and if he can't afford an attorney, he will appoint an attorney. He'll set bond conditions, or perhaps order after a hearing that the defendant be detained. The magistrate judges issue search warrants, arrest warrants, electronic surveillance warrants, and a lot of other things that assist in a criminal investigation. So we have a wide range of duties, and
it sounds like you do pretty much everything a federal district judge does, except have to go through the Senate confirmation process.
Well, that's pretty much true, with one exception. The one thing magistrate judges cannot do under the Constitution is try a felony case.
I see.
And sentence defendants on a felony charge. We can try misdemeanor offenses. But the one thing we can't do is try a felony case.
Well, that with that one exception, you're essentially doing the same job. And back in the day when I used to practice, I dealt very frequently in federal court with federal magistrate judges, and I've had some very good experiences with them, and it's a very, very important job. And indeed, it's been my experience also, as I've watched from afar, that many times federal magistrate judges eventually get elevated to the Article III bench.
And, that's frequently true. That's frequently true. I think that speaks well for the quality of judges or magistrate judges that have been hired, especially in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. I think we do perform a pretty valuable function in assisting our federal courts in managing their dockets.
Well, really an essential function these days in the overloaded court system. So that's very important stuff. Well, among the many duties you mentioned, of course, you talked about issuing warrants and surveillance warrants, that sort of thing. And that, of course, was the reason that we're talking today, is that a couple weeks ago I saw your article, or an article about you, in the New York Times. Adam Liptak wrote an article. He's one of their Supreme Court and federal judges, federal judiciary correspondents. And it's a fascinating subject. You've apparently just published an article, or will shortly publish an article, in the Harvard Law and Policy Review about surveillance. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. It should be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Well, we can't wait to see it. But in the meantime, why don't you tell us what it's about?
Okay. Well, this article kind of grew out of my experience as a magistrate judge, and it's been kind of in gestation, I guess, for many years. When I came to this job, I had no experience in criminal law and dealing with search warrants or things of that sort. My experience was entirely on the civil side of the bench. And so one of the things that was new to me when I started doing this job was that the government agents and attorneys were frequently come to us and ask us to sign orders authorizing the government to get information from the phone company, or perhaps the electronic service providers, about the customer's accounts, their phone records, email records, that sort of thing. And this is all done under a statute known as the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know anything about that law. We refer to it as ECPA. And so my initial question was, well, what is the legal standard for getting this information?
Well, before we go on, Judge, what exactly are you being asked to order here?
To order the phone companies to turn over to law enforcement phone records, including very often records of the location of the phones when it's in use. And typically these orders last for a 60-day period, 30 to 60 days. They ask for a record of all the numbers dialed by that phone and all the phone numbers that call that phone. Those are referred to as a PIN register.
Mm-hmm.
The same statute also deals with email records and allows the government to get access to those those records of your emails, text messages, things of that sort, that basically the customer's usage of these electronic devices.
Okay, so the government could say, I want to know Stuart Harris's cell phone's whereabouts for the last 3 months. And cell phones have been described recently as being tracking devices that you can talk on. Because, of course, by triangulation, they can tell within a few meters of where you are at any given time if you're carrying your cell phone in your pocket. So they would ask you to say, I want to know what Stuart Harris's cell phone, where it's been for the last 3 months. I want to know who he's called and who's called him. And, by the way, I want to know about any other text messages or anything else he sent out of there.
Right. That's essentially right.
They have to get a warrant for that, right?
Well, ordinarily, to get a tracking device, I mean, there's a history. There was and is case law dealing with what the government has to do in order to put a tracking device, say, on a car to follow someone, or in a container. The Supreme Court has basically said that if law enforcement wants to track someone by that means, and that tracking device, which is usually or traditionally has been a form of a beeper or something like that, emitting a radio signal, if that device is monitored while it's in the home or office or other constitutionally protected space that is not open to public view, that you typically have to get a warrant under the Fourth Amendment, which typically also requires that the government show probable cause to believe that the information is relevant to a criminal investigation or that it will reveal criminal activity. And so that's a fairly high standard.
So if they wanted those records from me,
devices, then the issue is, okay, is a cell phone, when it's used in this way to get information about your location, is it not the equivalent of a tracking device, a beeper? And if so, then why shouldn't you require a warrant? The government says, no, it's not the equivalent, because under this statute, under ECPA, it allows, arguably, the government to obtain information regarding the use of the device, the signaling information or whatever, and it's not technically a tracking device. Therefore, under ECPA, you can get this information under a lesser standard than probable cause.
What's the standard under ECPA?
Under ECPA, the standard is that there is, the government shows specific and articulable facts giving grounds to believe that a crime has been committed and that the information is relevant to this criminal investigation. It's been termed a reasonable suspicion type of standard, but it's not as strict as probable cause.
Okay, well, let me just put this in context again. Thinking back years ago to when I was in law school, generally speaking, whenever the government wants to get personal information about me, information that, you know, is within my so-called zone of privacy, and, you know, we can debate what exactly that is, but certainly I think my cell phone is a private thing, and I think who I call is a private thing, and I think where I am on a given day is a private thing. So normally they'd have to have fairly high standard, probable cause to believe that I had committed a crime or I was about to commit a crime, and then they'd have to go to you, an independent member of the judiciary, and convince you of that, and then you'd issue something called a warrant, and that would satisfy the Fourth Amendment. What you're telling me is that this federal statute seems to authorize a significantly lower standard, something that's similar to what we sometimes call a reasonable suspicion, which is something less than probable cause. It sort of sounds like an end run around the Fourth Amendment.
Well, it's certainly a lower standard than the Fourth Amendment. Whether it's an end run or not, it depends on, I guess, where you're sitting. Some of the information that is obtainable under this the lesser ECPA standard is arguably not something that you might have a reasonable expectation of privacy in. It's account information, the name and address of the subscriber, or actually the phone numbers dialed and the phone numbers calling into your phone. The Supreme Court has held that customers do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that information.
Hmm.
So there are broad categories of information that the phone company has that arguably would not trigger, or probably do not trigger, a reasonable expectation of privacy. The issue is whether or not this location information does. And the problem is that the statute is not specific. It doesn't really specifically refer to location information. Now, it talks about signaling and other types of information, but at the time ECPA was passed back in 1986, the capabilities of cell phones were not well known. In fact, I'm not sure many people had cell phones by that, at that point.
Nobody that I knew had. It may be a doctor or two, $5,000 cell phone or something.
Exactly. But so Congress, and even when they amended the statute in subsequent years, never really zeroed in on what is the proper standard for getting location information. Now, there is and has been a debate over the years as to how precise the location information needs to be before it would trigger a reasonable expectation of privacy. So, for example, in years past, probably 10 or 15 years ago, the generalized information, the cell site data, we call it, that the cell phone towers that relay the radio information from your phone to the rest of the phone system, the information derived from that was probably not very specific. Arguably less than, 500 meters, 500,000 meters, something that would really just perhaps identify the general neighborhood or perhaps zip code where you were, but wouldn't specifically point to a particular house or something.
Yeah, but this was all before GPS. I mean, back in 1986.
It was before GPS, yeah. And before other methods of identifying location information through triangulation have been developed.
Mm-hmm.
So these days, it is certainly the case that your cell phone can be tracked within, as you say, probably depending if it's GPS, as close as 10 meters or so.
Wow, this does sound a little frightening. I've got my cell phone in my pocket right now, and I've got it muted, but it's definitely still turned on. And so theoretically speaking, the government could be asking someone just like you, let us know where Harris is today, effectively, because we want to know all of his locational records. We want to know who he was calling and who was calling him. And let's be a little bit more specific. Can they actually listen in on my phone calls, or can they actually read my emails or text messages under ECPA?
There's a separate question. They can't listen in to your phone call without getting a wiretap order.
Much is still under the Fourth Amendment, at least the traditional Fourth Amendment analysis.
That's even a higher standard than probable cause, because there are other statutory requirements that a government would have to meet, minimization, and only certain crimes will allow them to get that type of information. So that has to go to a district judge. That authority is not given to magistrate judges. Now, the content of emails is not as strictly protected as your oral conversations on the phone.
You can order a phone company to reveal my emails to the government under only the lower standard of ECPA?
Well, it's more complicated than that. It depends on how old the email is. If it's older than 180 days, that information is deemed to be stored information, and it's arguably obtainable without a warrant under the lesser standard of a reasonable suspicion. If it's younger or not as old as 180 days, they do still need to get a warrant. The issue is whether or not they need to give notice to the individual, and that's where the statute's kind of, at least in my view, perhaps could use some updating.
It's your weekly constitutional, and we're speaking with federal magistrate Stephen Smith, who's written a law review article about a really frightening circumstance, secret surveillance orders. You heard that right. Surveillance orders that federal and state judges issue, authorizing the government to listen in on, well, or at least look at lots of your communications and maybe even track you via your cell phone. And you may never, ever find out about these orders. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more to federal magistrate Stephen Smith. Stick around.
Hey, everybody, gather round. It's the privacy song. I don't have no privacy, neither do you. The government is watching us, and Walmart's watching too. Your doctor keeps your urine for to clone your DNA. Those albums that you bought last night, well, now they know you're gay.
Well, it's time once again for our constitutional quiz with our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael, from the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. How are you, Kelly?
I'm well. How are you, Stuart?
I am doing so well. I'm just excited about how well I am. And we even have a contestant with us here today.
Excellent. Who do we have today, Stuart?
This is Brent Easton. I'm from Canaan Valley, West Virginia.
All right.
Okay, Brent, are you ready for the quiz?
I am.
All right. Kelly, why don't you go ahead and sock him with the question?
All right, Brett, I'm hoping you're a fan of the Bill of Rights because the question is regarding the Bill of Rights. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. The Bill of Rights were added to the Constitution, was it A, during the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, B, in the preamble before Article 1 of the Constitution, C, during the Civil War in 1863, or D, at the end of the text after the seven articles?
Okay, those are some interesting choices. Could you give us the answer choices again, Kelly?
Yeah, I'd like to hear those one more time. I think I know the answer.
All right, Brett, here we go, because this is, you know, we have this great award for you, this great T-shirt that says your weekly constitutional. So let's make sure you're listening. You ready? Here we go. The Bill of Rights were added to the Constitution. Was it A, during the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, B, in the preamble before Article 1, C, during the Civil War in 1863, or D, at the end of the text after the seven articles?
Why don't we go through those in order, Brent? Okay. How about A? Was it added during the Constitutional Convention?
I don't believe it was, no.
Okay. How come? Why do you not think so?
Well, I kind of feel like it was proposed by Madison, I think, in maybe 1790. And I feel like it was...
So you think it was just afterward?
I feel like it was all finalized in 1791, but I'm not sure.
Okay, well then, I guess that would also answer B, so it couldn't have been in the preamble either.
No, not in the preamble.
Okay, what was C again? Was it during the Civil War?
C had to do with the Civil War. It wasn't then. That was much later.
A bit later, so I guess that leaves D.
And what was D one more time?
At the end of the text, after the seven articles.
I guess I'm going to have to go with that.
Okay, is that your final answer?
That's my final answer.
Kelly, how do you do?
Well, Brett, congratulations. You are a proud owner of your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
Well, that's just marvelous. How do you feel?
Really good.
Really good?
Yeah, big time. I mean,
do you think
Brett, you were really close when you said, you're somewhat close when you said 1790 that James Madison proposed the Bill of Rights, but it actually was earlier than that. It was passed in 1789, September 25th, 1789, so almost 2 years after our Constitution was ratified. And then the Bill of Rights wasn't actually ratified until 1791.
Right, and there was a great deal of
of controversy about this. One of the major objections of the anti-federalists, both at the convention and subsequently during the ratification process, was that there was no Bill of Rights. In fact, rather famously, George Mason and several other people who'd been at the convention refused to sign the original seven articles because there was no Bill of Rights. And so in order to convince the anti-federalists to ratify, many of the proponents of the Constitution, the so-called Federalists, promised that the first order of business of the new Congress would be to pass a Bill of Rights, and that's what they did, just as Kelly just described. And so it was appended at the end of the first seven articles. And in fact, if you go to the National Archives today, you'll see the first seven articles displayed in one case, and then you'll see the Bill of Rights off in a case by itself.
And Stuart, perhaps you can add a little bit more about, you know, at one point there was a debate of when we amend our Constitution, should we be amending the actual text itself, or are we adding more language, adding amendments to the Constitution? So the answer choice that Brett did a great job answering was we add the Bill of Rights to the end of the text after the seven articles. And why didn't we just include it within the articles?
Well, because they didn't have word processors back then. I think it was basically just a, you know, to a great extent, just a pragmatic debate. I mean, it's very hard to go back and interpolate language or insert it, you know, so you just tack it on to the end. And that's what we've done with all the 27 amendments, even those that we have first ratified and then repealed, like the 18th Amendment, which was subsequently repealed. And that brings up an interesting modern story, and that is, of course, that recently Congress read the entire Constitution aloud at the beginning of the congressional session. And there was some debate over whether they should read every word of it or they should not read parts of it which had either been specifically repealed or had been effectively repealed by later amendments. And they went with the second approach. There were certain parts of the Constitution that were simply left unread, such as the Fugitive Slave Clause, because they have been effectively amended, effectively changed by, in that case, the 13th Amendment. Anyway, Brett, you did a great job today. Thanks very much. We appreciate your playing. And now, do you think this will increase your chances with the ladies when you wear the T-shirt around?
More than likely, I would say.
Yeah, that happens. That happens a great deal. Okay, thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. Have a good one.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to federal magistrate Stephen Smith about secret surveillance orders and just the general concept of privacy. Do we have any left? Let's ask Judge Smith. Just to summarize again, you know, the standard law book, standard Fourth Amendment analysis requires before someone, the government, invades my privacy, it's got to go to somebody like you and get a warrant based on probable cause. But we've got this 1986 statute based on the technology of the day that gives establishes a lower standard for certain types of electronic communication information, including perhaps the location of a cell phone. Phone numbers dialed, phone numbers received, email sent, text messages sent or received, and it's just easier for the government to get access to all of that. Now, that's, of course, of great concern to a lot of us, because I can think of a lot of emails I've sent that I don't particularly want people looking at. And, okay, so that's of great concern in and of itself. But your focus in your article that's coming out in the Harvard Law and Policy Review is that all of these requests, well, I'll let you tell. What is your concern?
Well, the concern that I have is not so much what the substantive standards are, although I have taken some positions on that, but I think that needs to be left to Congress and the representative branches of government to say what that should be. But my concern is that Congress doesn't have a very intelligent or sound empirical basis on which to legislate, because they don't know how many of these orders are being requested, how many of these orders are being issued. They don't know what types of crimes they are primarily being used for. And the reason they don't know is because all these orders are issued in secret.
Wait a minute. This is federal court. This is court which are supposed to be open to the public.
Right.
And you're telling me that these things are all being done in secret?
Right. And
so I don't know if the government's been asking to read my emails.
Well, no, you won't know unless you're charged with a crime. Now, you know, keep in mind that the reason that at what stage we're talking about, this is not this is the before a crime has been charged and before a defendant has been indicted or even arrested. They're investigating, and so it really makes sense, at least for some limited temporary period of time, for these type of orders to be sealed. So that the target doesn't know he or she's been investigated, so that they can perhaps destroy evidence or flee or do something to jeopardize the investigation. I think there's a legitimate argument to be made for a temporary period of secrecy or sealing under which these orders shouldn't be disclosed. The difficulty and the main problem I have is that long after these investigations are done, long after many times the defendants are charged and the case is tried or settled or plea bargained out, these orders that we issue remain sealed. And so the public, number one, can't get access to them, so they don't know how many of these orders are being issued. And only the defendants would know whether or not their phone records or email records have been accessed as part of the investigation. I mean, they would have a right to get that information from the government in order to defend their case. But the truly disturbing thing is that people who are not charged with a crime, ultimately, presumably therefore law-abiding citizens, will not know that their phone records or email records have been accessed by the government and won't be able to find out. In fact, they're precluded from finding out, even if they asked their electronic service provider, their phone company or email provider, hey, has the government or anybody accessed my records? Those companies are forbidden from telling their customers by virtue of gag orders. Or non-disclosure orders that the court issues at simultaneously at the same time the orders are signed.
Oh boy,
and,
Judge,
and
you brought
these orders
up,
continue indefinitely.
Oh boy, you're talking about an extremely important issue here called prior restraint. Whenever the courts issue an order like that, a so-called gag order, and they say don't talk about this, that is one of the biggest issues in all of the First Amendment. And you're essentially telling me that there are many, many of these gag orders out there covering many, many people, and the companies can't talk about this, and these people will therefore never receive that information that they were the subject of government surveillance.
That's exactly true. That is the case.
And wow.
I do think there's a significant First Amendment issue in this area. But again, the First Amendment is not absolute. I mean, obviously, there are times when at least some limited gagging or limited non-disclosure of a temporary nature might be justified. But it seems to me that at most, it could only be justified during the course of the investigation. Once the investigation is closed, then I don't see any continuing need for this. And that was really the focus of my article.
Yeah, that's, of course, the concern. I think most reasonable people will recognize that if you're going after some terrorist or if you're going after some terrible criminal, that you obviously don't want to warn them that, you know, hey, by the way, we're going to be listening in on you.
Right.
You're not going to call up Tony Soprano and warn him.
Right.
On the other hand, after you've investigated Tony Soprano and you've decided whether to charge him or not, and you, by the way, you know, listened in on or in some sense been following everybody he's called and everybody who's called him, including lots of innocent people, maybe those innocent people should be informed or at least be allowed to learn that their communications were the subject or at least were part of an investigation that didn't result in them being charged with anything.
Exactly.
Is that your solution? Is that you'd propose that these gag orders would be lifted at a certain point or that these records become more available to the public after a certain point?
That's part of my solution. And in the article, I talk about several things that I think can be done. One of the things I try to do when I issue these orders is to put a shelf life or a time limit on how long they can remain sealed and how long they these non-disclosure or gag orders remain in effect. Typically, what I'll do is say, all right, the orders can be sealed for 180 days, 6 months, and then they're going to be unsealed after that time unless the government tells me, no, wait a minute, the investigation is still ongoing, or maybe this is, even if the investigation is closed, that there may be a significant possibility that somebody's going to be harmed or injured suffer some serious injury as a result of the disclosure. But you know, at least at that point, the government has made some sort of showing to me, and then I can modify it at that point. But I'm kind of the exception to the rule.
So your colleagues on the bench are not doing this?
Not uniformly, although you know, some, I think, share my concerns. But the difficulty is, and there are 500 magistrate judges around the country and in all different districts, and it's more work for us.
It would be, wouldn't it?
Well, but I think it's work that we need to do, but on the other hand, it is something that requires additional effort, and not only on our part, but on the U.S. Attorney's part, and so there, you know, that's maybe some resistance there. I don't think that's the major thing why it hasn't been done. I think it's just a matter of the issue hasn't gotten a lot of attention yet, and that was frankly one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it to light.
Did you have any trouble getting that information from your colleagues? I mean, if there's so much secrecy shrouding this entire process, were you able to simply send out an email to the 500 magistrate judges and say, hey, guys, what's up?
No. I wish it had been that easy. No, the problem is all those orders are sealed. And so in order for them to, even judges from different districts would have some difficulty accessing sealed documents from another district. So what I tried to do is, what I wanted to focus on was how many of these orders are we issuing every year? I just want to get some grasp on the scope of the problem. Because as you mentioned, I mean, the federal court, as in other courts in our country, I mean, we have an open court system. We pride ourselves on doing things in public, on public records, and issuing written opinions so that the public can understand what we do and why we do it, and therefore get some confidence that justice being done. I mean, I don't think you can do justice behind closed doors or justice in a corner unless it's perceived by the public that what we're doing is open and above board, then it's not going to be accepted that way. So in any event, it took some doing to find out how many of these orders were being issued, and I had access to the cases in our district. I tried to get access based on what was publicly available in other districts and did a fair amount of extrapolation, but the number that I came up with was that magistrate judges were issuing, at least as of 2006, were issuing at least 30,000 of these orders every year.
30,000 a year?
30,000.
And that's for all magistrate judges?
That's for all U.S. magistrate judges. Now, that does not include state court judges,
and they can also issue these things on direct.
Who can also issue these type of orders? And keep in mind that the great majority of criminal proceedings in this country are handled at the state and local level. Federal judges only handle a fraction of the total criminal volume of cases in this country. So, if we're doing 30,000 a year, you can safely assume that a much larger number is being issued out of state courts.
Yeah, in fact, think about it. There are 50 states. I mean, you know, you're one of 51 judicial systems.
Right.
And some of those states are awfully big, and they have an awful lot of judges issuing a lot of orders every day. So it sounds like there are lots and lots of surveillance going on.
Right, and keep in mind, too, this was back in 2006. What I was able to do was access, I piggybacked off a study that was done by the Federal Judicial Center of sealed cases in federal court, mm-hmm. and they studied every case filed in 2006, and then checked to see how many of those were sealed, and that was all types of cases. My focus was, okay, of that sample size, how many of those were electronic surveillance orders, and so that was the number that I came up with. Now, I know that was now, what, 6 years ago. I know the number of electronic surveillance orders has been increasing over time, and I think it's I was actually rather surprised to see a recent article in the New York Times reporting on the number of surveillance requests that phone companies have responded to. And this was done in response to a request from Congressman Markey, I believe, from Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
Earlier in the year, asked 8 or 9 phone companies, how many of these requests are you getting from law enforcement every year? And according to their responses, which came out, were publicized a couple of months ago, last year there were 1.3 million of these surveillance requests that were made last year just to phone companies.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're speaking with federal magistrate Stephen Smith about secret surveillance orders. After the break, we'll find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll talk some more to Judge Stephen Smith. Stay tuned.
We ain't talking alone. Who's listening? But I don't really know. But you better tell the SIS to keep out of sight, 'cause I know they're taking pictures on me ultraviolet light. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, but these days.
So Kelly, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Uh-oh, Kelly. I remember the episode where you did
Kelly.
Yes, the cheer song.
Kelly
thank
song.
You.
That was good. Yes, I know. We need to play that again.
I don't know about that.
All right. What's happening this week?
November 17th, we have the Civil War Trail and Gilmore Farm walking tour.
Oh, very interesting. So what's going to happen with that?
So tour guests who come join us will get to go to the Montpelier Civil War Camp, where General Samuel McGowan's South Carolina Brigade encamped during the winter of 1863 and 1864, just right on the other side of the road from James and Dolly Madison's home.
And that was a big encampment.
Yeah.
There were thousands of soldiers. It was a friendly encampment. I mean, this was a southern plantation then.
Yep. And while you're here, you get to visit the Gilmore Farm, which is a freedman's home, a home of a former Montpelier slave, George Gilmore, who mm-hmm. was emancipated after the Civil War.
Right.
And George and his wife Polly raised five children when they were in this cabin that we have still here at Montpelier.
Right. It's very well preserved, too, isn't
it? Well preserved, yep.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a marvelous event. What's the date again?
November 17th.
November the 17th. Now, is that a Saturday?
That is a Saturday.
Okay. And what time does that start?
It is, the tour will begin at the Gilmore Cabin at 2:30 p.m. So you can come, do a tour of the mansion, and then go, you know, explore Gilmore Cabin.
That afternoon. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Kelly.
Great. Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with federal magistrate Stephen Smith about secret surveillance orders. One of the most troubling things about these orders is that it's quite possible that you'll be followed, you'll be surveilled in some sense, and you'll never, ever find out about it unless you are charged with a crime. And to reiterate what you said rather earlier, now, if ever one of these does result in a criminal prosecution, and if ever the government tries to use these intercepts, any of this information as evidence, then obviously the criminal defendant in that case is going to have an opportunity to challenge all of this under the Fourth Amendment and perhaps in some other fashion as well.
Right.
And, you know, that'll be litigated. You know, then
right.
the questions will be brought before the court. You know, was this the appropriate standard? You know, was it met, et cetera, et cetera. But if a person is surveilled and never knows about it, then that person will never have the opportunity, would never have the reason to challenge that. So there could theoretically be all sorts of constitutional violations going on out there that will continue forever as long as they're not challenged.
Unfortunately, that's exactly true.
That's the real problem here, isn't it? Is if we don't even know if we're being watched, then we have no basis for challenging it.
Right. That's the nub. And not only that is because all of this surveillance is really going on under the radar, it's not only concealed from the general public, it's concealed from appellate courts.
Mm-hmm.
Because unless, you know, appellate courts only hear appeals filed by parties whose rights have been, they feel like have been violated at the lower court level. And so if you don't know that your rights have been violated, you're not going to file appeals. And so that means that appellate courts, including the Supreme Court, see very few of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't have the opportunity to interpret the laws. And because any law has gaps and holes and rough edges that need to be refined and adjudicated by a court of appeals, and that's just the way our process works. The trial courts get their first shot at interpreting these laws, and then a court of appeals will tell the court whether or not they got it right or set the proper standard. And that way, trial courts and magistrate judges learn what the proper standard is in applying a certain law. But unfortunately, with ECPA, we're just in a dark hole because the normal appeals process doesn't work. It can't work because the parties who have an incentive to file appeals don't know that they need to file an appeal. Now, the one party that is aware of what's going on and might be able to appeal is the government, but
they're not going to file appeals on the basis of the
right,
defendants.
They have no incentive to do that.
No, they're not going to do that. In fact, it sounds if the courts are ignorant of what's going on, then I'm guessing Congress, to a great extent, is ignorant of what it has wrought with this act.
Well, and that's exactly true, too, because there's no automatic reporting of how many of these orders are issued every year or what type of cases they're issued in, which agency, FBI or the DEA or immigration, which agencies are primarily responsible for the great number of requests. So Congress doesn't know exactly what's going on under the laws that they've already authorized. So they are in a very difficult position in trying to monitor what's going on to see what areas of the law need to be improved, to see whether or not the balance that they originally thought they struck when they passed this law between privacy and security is being maintained.
Right, or whether it needs to be revised based upon technological advances.
Exactly. Technology is just galloping down the road, and unfortunately, although I think this 1986 law did a fairly good job and for many years, but it is woefully inadequate now. And,
that was 1986. We were all still watching the Bill Cosby show. Okay, I mean, this is the Ronald Reagan was in the White House. I mean, this is ancient history in terms of technology. So I'm going to venture a guess here and say that I think that this article is a great public service, Judge, and that you're providing some extremely important information for Congress, for the courts, for the general public, which ultimately, of course, is the sovereign in our nation. People need to know this if they're to make any reasoned decision about whether this is something they want or not want.
I appreciate that, and I think you're exactly right. And that's the idea, that if we're our nation of laws and Congress is the institution that we turn to make intelligent decisions and policy choices, they need to be informed and they need to have the best information. And if they don't have that, then we're all going to be very, very ill-served.
Well, Judge, I rarely make any predictions. People ask me all the time to predict, for example, outcome of Supreme Court cases, and I almost always demur. But on this case, I'm going to make a prediction. I'm going to make a prediction that your article is going to be one of the most cited cases in criminal cases over the next 5 years of any law review article that gets published.
Well,
I think so, because I think lots of defense lawyers are going to be waving these statistics around as they make their Fourth Amendment arguments on behalf of their clients.
Well,
and in fact, I bet they're waiting over at the ACLU to get their hands on this, too. So I think you've opened up a real can of worms here, Judge. I hope you're ready for the publicity.
Well, I don't mind the publicity on an issue like this that I think that the public needs to know. And, you know, ordinarily I know judges are fairly reticent to talk to members of the press. And I think rightfully so if we're talking about a particular case or a pending case and that sort of thing. But that's not the issue here, I don't think, because we're not really focused on a particular investigation. We're focused on a broader policy question that I think is very important.
And you're one of the few people who could have written about it, yeah, because you're one of the few people who actually is seeing this and knows to some extent what's going on, at least in your own court. And like you say, you're one of the few people, one of the few actors in the judicial system that has any incentive to bring this out. And so I do think you've done a great public service here. Now, we're running short on time. Is there anything else you'd care to add before we finish?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. You're very kind in your comments, and all I can do is just hope that people pay attention to this issue and write their congressman or get involved and it's an important debate that we need to have. And in order to be able to debate it intelligently, we need good information. And so I hope I've played a small part in that.
Well, you have. Federal Magistrate Stephen Smith, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with Federal Magistrate Stephen Smith about his concerns about privacy and about protecting information, especially about these secret surveillance orders. A little creepy subject there, and a very important one. Now let's take just a minute and talk about a more pleasant subject. Let's speak with Julie Silverbrook and a student competition called the Virtual Supreme Court. Julie Silverbrook, welcome to your Weekly Constitutional.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Now, tell us who you are and what you do.
I am the executive director of the Constitutional Sources Project, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization devoted to increasing understanding about the creation, ratification, and amendment of the United States Constitution.
Well, that sounds like a noble effort.
We think so.
Absolutely. Well, tell me, you've got right now, we're going to talk about something called, I believe, the Virtual Supreme Court. What's that?
So we are partnering with our friends at the Harlan Institute, and they're the group that runs Fantasy SCOTUS. I don't know if you...
Fantasy SCOTUS. Of course, everybody plays Fantasy SCOTUS, right?
Right. It's kind of like fantasy football.
Only much more interesting.
Popular. Yeah, much more interesting if you're interested in the law.
I just executed a trade, actually. I traded Scalia for Kennedy.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, a good trade. Kennedy is a significant vote, as he
absolutely.
You know, often determines the outcome of cases.
I wanted that determinate vote, absolutely. So I gave up a little bit of acerbic wit, and I got the determining vote. So I think it's a pretty good trade. All right, so tell me, what is up with that? What is it?
So this is it's a competition for high school students, and we're running it nationwide. It's absolutely free to participate, and it's a really low burden on educators because everything is done online. So essentially the students participate in the competition by researching a contemporary constitutional issue. This year's question is related to the Fisher v. UT Austin case, which is a challenge to a race-based affirmative action program down in Texas.
Right.
And we asked the fundamental constitutional question, which is the 14th Amendment colorblind? Which I think is a really interesting and thought-provoking question that was actually, comes in part from an opinion written by none other than Justice Harlan, which would be appropriate given that our partner is the Harlan Institute.
Yes, indeed.
And the students will submit persuasive appellate briefs online through the Harlan Institute's website. And we've asked, because ConSource has a large focus on primary source documents and the development of the Constitution throughout U.S. history, the students will be asked to use a variety of different primary source documents in constructing their appellate brief. From there, legal experts, including myself, will judge the briefs, will evaluate them, and will select the top 10 briefs, or maybe it's the top 4 briefs for each side, so top 8 briefs, which will then, those brief writers, the students, will then go on to the virtual oral argument segment of the competition. And the oral argument will take place in front of legal experts in what we're calling our virtual courtroom, which will take place over Google Plus video hangouts. So it's a really interesting use of technology, and it allows students, you know, in Montana, for example, to present oral argument in front of appellate attorneys who are in Washington, D.C.
That sounds pretty high tech.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's obviously, this is our inaugural competition, so it's going to be interesting to see how it works out. But I think the really exciting thing is the final round of the competition, which will be judged by top appellate attorneys in D.C. So these are individuals who very often argue in front of the United States Supreme Court. And the winning team will get an all-expense-paid trip to Consource's 2013 Constitution Day event here in Washington, D.C., which is where we're located.
Well, that just sounds really exciting. Now, let me get a little more clear on the requirements here. What sort of students are eligible to compete in this?
High school students, so anyone who is in a high school. I would guess that the type of questions, type of materials they're using would be most appropriate for a high school senior, but juniors and sophomores are allowed to apply as well.
Okay, and how do they do this? How do
they
join the competition?
They go to harlaninstitute.org,
mm-hmm.
and there's information on there about the virtual Supreme Court competition.
Harlan Institute, all one word,
mm-hmm.
.org. And they just simply look for the virtual Supreme Court competition. I imagine this is something that social studies teachers, history teachers also might want to incorporate in their classrooms.
Absolutely. We would love for that to happen. If any educators have questions, they can email me directly at julie.silverbrook@consource.org.
Okay, julie.silverbrook@consource.org.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds marvelous. And it sounds also, as you emphasized before, like it's a very little cost. All they have essentially have to have is internet access, right?
Internet access and a desire to learn and write.
Well, that's my kind of competition. Unfortunately, I'm too old to enter, so I don't think I will be doing so. But I certainly wish you the very best of luck with it, Julie. And maybe you can come back sometime and tell us how it went.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe we can do something with the two individuals who end up winning the competition. We'd love to, you know, highlight their work and have them share it with people on your program or elsewhere.
Sounds like a good plan. And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Federal Magistrate Stephen Smith for sharing his concerns about secret surveillance orders with us. Thanks also to Julie Silverbrook, who told us all about the virtual Supreme Court competition. Sounds like fun. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.